happy to be out of the cold, eating Chinese or burgers, smoking cigarettes and drinking beer. Joe cast them sidelong glances, but kept walking, leaning against the rain. He had blustered and complained about Ulbrichtsen right along with Shorty and Roger, but now that he was alone, the bluster faded, and the old weight of anxiety and self-doubt settled on him again. After all he had been through, it was obvious that he still remained utterly disposable, even at the crew house, the one place he had started to feel more or less at home. The day after their little chat in his office, Al Ulbrichtsen happily noted in his logbook that the sophomore boat suddenly snapped back into form, handily beating all four of the other boats on its first outing. Dodging rain squalls, rowing through whitecaps, stopping between races to bail out their shells, the five potential varsity crews went at it tooth and nail over the next several weeks, and through it all the sophomores seemed to have found themselves again. Ulbrichtsen decided to put them to the test. He staged a one-mile time trial. The sophomores leapt out to a one-length lead and never looked back, pulling away decisively at the halfway mark and cruising to a seemingly effortless win. But when Ulbrichtsen looked at his stopwatch, he was disappointed. They were about 10 seconds off the pace he was looking for at this point in the season. Nevertheless, they had won, so on the blackboard in the shell house the next day he finally listed the sophomore boat as the first varsity boat for the first time. The following day they rowed awkwardly and lost badly. Ulbrichtsen promptly demoted them to third boat. That night, writing in his logbook, a frustrated Ulbrichtsen tore them apart. Horrible! Every man for himself, no semblance of teamwork. Have gone to sleep entirely. Too much criticism. Need the old morale. A few days later, he held a 3-mile trial. The sophomores trailed the field for the first mile. In the second mile, they pulled even with the leading JV boat. Then they simply overpowered the older boys in the last mile to pull away and win by a convincing length and a half. Ulbrichtsen scratched his head and moved them back to first boat status on the blackboard. But as soon as he elevated them, they fell apart yet again. Dead from the bottom up, timing messed up. Rance holding slide and arms too long, he wrote in the logbook. By now, Ulbrichtsen was headed along the road from mild confusion to utter consternation, if not madness. He was, in his quiet way, rapidly becoming obsessed, almost Ahab-like, in his pursuit of the ultimate varsity crew, one that could beat Kai Ebright in California in April and at Poughkeepsie in June, and be in a position to go to Berlin the following year. Ebright was much on his mind. The normally vociferous Cal coach had gone uncharacteristically silent down in Berkeley. One Bay Area sports scribe took to calling him the Sphinx of Berkeley, and wondered if he even so much as said hello to his wife in the evening these days. The last time he had been so reserved was in the run-up to the 1928 and 1932 Olympic seasons. Now all that Ulbrichtsen could find in the Bay Area papers was the disconcerting tidbit that Dick Burnley, Cal's sensational stroke oar, who had so spectacularly powered Ebright's varsity to victory over Ulbrichtsen's boys in Poughkeepsie, had grown another half inch in height. Ebright was far from all that was confusing Ulbrichtsen, though, nor was it just the suddenly erratic performance of the sophomores on whom he had staked so much hope. Part of what he was wrestling with was, in fact, good news, an embarrassment of riches. He had begun to see a great deal of unexpected talent in some of his other boats. For starters, there was Tom Bull's new crop of freshmen. They were off limits for now, but Ulbrichtsen knew he had to factor them into his plans for next year, and next year was what mattered most. Bowles was reporting that the new crop was rowing just seconds off the kinds of record paces Joe and his crew had set the year before, and they seemed to be getting better each time out. There was a curly-headed kid at stroke in the freshman boat, Don Hume, who looked particularly promising. He wasn't polished yet, but he never seemed to tire, never showed pain, just kept going, kept driving forward, no matter what, like a well-oiled locomotive. In no position except for coxswain is experience so important as it is at stroke, though, and Hume still had a lot of experience to garner. There were a couple of other kids in the freshman crew that looked real good, too, a big, muscular, quiet boy named Gordy Adam in the No. 5 seat, and Johnny White in No. 2. White's father had once been a standout single sculler, and his boy just lived and breathed rowing. One of the JV boats, the one Bobby Mock was steering, the one that now and then left the all-sophomore boat in its wake, also contained a couple of promising surprises, also sophomores. There was another curly-headed boy, a 6'5", slightly goofy-looking beanpole with a smile that could knock your socks off, named Jim McMillan. His crewmates called him Stub. He had not rowed particularly well in the second freshman boat the previous year. Now, suddenly, he seemed to be finding his niche in Mock's boat. He was big enough to provide the leverage and power that a great crew needs in the middle of the boat, and he never seemed to believe that he was beaten, even if he was. He rowed as hard in a losing cause as in a winning one. He just plain had a lot of pepper, and he'd made it clear that he thought he belonged in the first boat. There was also a bespectacled boy named Chuck Day. Ulbrichsen had noticed him as a freshman. He was almost impossible to overlook, in fact, if only because he was a chatterbox and a prankster, and he made himself conspicuous. Like Hume, he hadn't yet smoothed out as an oarsman, but his natural inclination was to fight first and ask questions later, and it was starting to pay off for him. There were times when a crew needed that kind of spark plug to get it revved up and firing on all cylinders. As February gave way to March, Ulbrichsen decided it was time to change tactics again. He abandoned the notion of set crews and started mixing and matching men in different boats, telling them, "I will change men around until I get a varsity boat that walks off and leaves the other lineups. Then I will know I have the right combination together." He started off by moving Joe out of the all-sophomore boat. But just as it had the year before, when Tom Bowles took Joe out, the boat slowed down. The next day, Joe was back in the boat. Ulbrichsen tried Stub McMillan in the number 7 seat in the sophomore boat, but then took him out the next day. He tried taking Joe out again, with the same results. He moved Shorty Hunt into the JV boat Mock was coxing. He swapped boys in and out of each and every boat. As March wore on, he gradually began to settle on two leading contenders for varsity status, one of the previous season's JV boats, the one with Mock, McMillan, and Day in it, and the original sophomore boat, still intact despite his various attempts at dismantling and improving it. Both boats were now logging impressive trial times, but neither seemed able to beat the other decisively. Ulbrichsen needed one or the other of them to break through, if only to put him out of his misery. But it just wasn't happening. Ulbrichsen knew what the real problem was. He littered his logbook with the myriad technical faults he was observing. Rance and Hartman still weren't breaking their arms at the right point in the stroke. Green and Hartman were catching the water too early. Rance and Lund were catching it too late, and so on. But the real problem wasn't that. Wasn't an accumulation of small faults. Back in February, he had commented to the Seattle Times' George Varnell that there are more good individual men on this year's squad than on any I have coached. The fundamental problem lay in the fact that he had felt compelled to throw that word individual into the sentence. There were too many days when they rowed not as crews but as boatfuls of individuals. The more he scolded them for personal technical issues, even as he preached teammanship, the more the boys seemed to sink into their own separate and sometimes defiant little worlds. The nasty weather that had assaulted Seattle since the previous October finally broke, though not before spitting a late spring snowstorm at the city for good measure on March 21st. On April 2nd, a warm sun blossomed over Lake Washington. On campus, students emerged from the mustiness of Suzzallo Library and the dankness of their rented rooms, blinked warily, and looked about for a place to stretch out on a patch of grass. Boys appeared wearing sports shirts and white shoes for the first time since the previous summer. Girls appeared wearing flowery skirts and ankle socks. The many cherry trees on the quad burst into blossom. Robins hopped around on the grass, cocking their heads, listening for worms. The first violet-green swallows of the year swirled among the spires of the library. Sunlight streamed through the windows into classrooms where professors gave halting lectures as they gazed out onto the sun-washed campus. At the shell house, the crew boys stripped off their jerseys and stretched out on the ramp, basking like lithe white lizards in the sun. The custodian at the canoe house noted a sudden demand for canoes, all of them rented by boy-girl combinations. The Daily ran a banner headline, "Campus Blotto with Influx of Love, Birds." Joe and Joyce were among the first of those to rent a canoe. Joyce was still living and working at the judge's house and hating the job more with each passing day. Joe figured maybe it would help to get her out on the water. He found her wearing a summer dress, sitting on the lawn in front of the library, chatting with some girlfriends. He took her by the hand and rushed her down to the canoe house. There he stripped off his shirt, helped her into a boat, and paddled briskly across the cut. He made his way lazily among the green expanse of lily pads and beaver lodges on the south side of Union Bay, until he found a spot he liked. Then he let the boat drift. Joyce reclined in the bow, trailing a hand in the water, soaking up the sun. Joe stretched out as best he could in the stern, gazing up at the translucent blue sky. From time to time a frog croaked and plopped into the water, alarmed by the slow approach of the drifting boat. Blue dragonflies hovered overhead, their wings rattling dryly. Red-winged blackbirds clung to reeds along the shoreline, chortling. Lulled by the subtle rocking of the canoe, Joe began to drift off. As Joe slept, Joyce sat in the bow, studying the face of the young man to whom she had committed herself. He had grown even more handsome since high school, and at moments like this, when he was fully at ease, his face and his sculpted body were so full of composure and grace that they reminded Joyce of the ancient marble statues of Greek athletes that she had recently studied in her art history class. Looking at him like this, she thought, it was hard to believe that he had ever known a troubled moment. Sleek mahogany motorboats roared by on their way from Lake Washington into the cut, their co-eds in bathing suits perched on the rear decks, waving at them as they passed. Their wide wakes rippled through the lily pads and rolled the canoe abruptly from side to side, prodding Joe back to alertness. He smiled at Joyce, who was beaming at him from the bow. He sat up, shook his head to clear his mind, took his guitar out of its battered old case, and began to sing. He sang at first the songs he and Joyce had sung together on the school bus back in Squim, funny, happy-go-lucky songs, songs that made them both laugh. And Joyce joined in joyfully again, just as she had back then. Then Joe slipped into soft, slow, sweet love songs, and Joyce grew quiet, listening carefully, happy in a different, deeper way. When Joe stopped playing, they talked about what it would be like when they were married, and had a home, and maybe kids. They talked earnestly, continuously, without respite, and with no sense of time passing, until the sun began to sink behind Capitol Hill, and Joyce grew cold in her light dress, and Joe paddled them back to the university side of the bay and helped her out of the boat. It was a day that both of them would remember well into old age. The next day, Joe, still feeling awash with goodwill, bought a little gas, drove his old Franklin over to Fremont, and parked in front of the Golden Rule Dairy and Bakery. He rolled the window down and waited, trying to enjoy the rich smell of baking bread, but too nervous to really savor it. A little after noon, men dressed in white streamed out of the building and began sitting on the lawn opening lunchboxes. A bit later, a few men in dark coveralls emerged, and Joe spotted his father immediately. At 6'2", he was easily the tallest man in the group. He did not appear to have changed at all. Even his coveralls looked to be the ones he'd always worn back on the farm in Squim. Joe climbed out of the car and trotted across the street. Harry looked up, saw him coming, and froze in place, clutching his lunchbox. Joe stuck out his hand and said, "Hi, Pop." Startled, Harry said nothing but took his son's hand. It had been 5.5 years since he'd seen Joe. He was no longer the scrawny kid he had left behind in Squim. He had to wonder, had Joe come to confront him or forgive him? "Hi, Joe. It's swell to see you." The two of them crossed the street and climbed into the front of the Franklin. Harry unwrapped a salami sandwich and silently offered half of it to Joe. They began to eat, and then, after a long, awkward silence, to talk. At first, Harry talked mostly about the equipment in the bakery, the huge ovens and dough mixers and the fleet of delivery trucks that he maintained. Joe allowed his father to go on at length, not particularly interested, but reveling in the familiar sound of his big, deep voice. the voice that had told him so many stories while sitting at night on the steps of the cabin at the Gold and Ruby Mine, the voice that had taught him so much as they tinkered with machinery back in Squim or hunted for bee trees out in the woods. When Joe finally started to talk, questions about his half-siblings tumbled out. How was Harry Jr. doing? Had he ever caught up with his schooling after the accident with the bacon grease? How big was Mike now? How were the girls getting on? Harry assured him they were all well. There was a long pause. Joe asked if he could come by and see them. Harry looked down at his lap and said, "I don't reckon so, Joe." Deep down in Joe's gut, something surged. Anger, disappointment, resentment. He wasn't sure what, but it was old and familiar and painful. But then, after another pause, Harry added without looking up, "Sometimes Tula and I go off on little excursions, though. Nobody home but the kids, then." He looked out the window as if distancing himself from what he'd just said. He seemed relieved. Joe wasn't going to ask him about that awful night in Squim when they'd left him behind. There is a thing that sometimes happens in rowing that is hard to achieve and hard to define. Many crews, even winning crews, never really find it. Others find it but can't sustain it. It's called swing. It only happens when all eight oarsmen are rowing in such perfect unison that no single action by any one is out of sync with those of all the others. It's not just that the oars enter and leave the water at precisely the same instant. 16 arms must begin to pull, 16 knees must begin to fold and unfold, 8 bodies must begin to slide forward and backward, 8 backs must bend and straighten all at once. Each minute action, each subtle turning of wrists, must be mirrored exactly by each oarsman, from one end of the boat to the other. Only then will the boat continue to run, unchecked, fluidly and gracefully between pulls of the oars. Only then will it feel as if the boat is a part of each of them, moving as if on its own. Only then does pain entirely give way to exaltation. Rowing then becomes a kind of perfect language. Poetry. That's what a good swing feels like. A good swing does not necessarily make crews go faster, except to the extent that if no one's actions check the run of the boat, rowers get more bang for their buck on each stroke. Mainly what it does is allow them to conserve power, to row at a lower stroke rate and still move through the water as efficiently as possible, and often more rapidly than another crew rowing less efficiently at a higher rate. It allows them to possess a reserve of energy for a gut-wrenching, muscle-screaming sprint at the end of a race. It is insanely difficult to keep a good swing as you raise your rate. As the tempo increases, each of the myriad separate actions has to happen at shorter and shorter intervals, so that at some point it becomes virtually impossible to maintain a good swing at a high rate. But the closer a crew can come to that ideal, maintaining a good swing while rowing at a high rate, the closer they are to rowing on another plane, the plane on which champions row. Joe and his crewmates had found their swing as freshmen, the day they'd won in Poughkeepsie, and Al Ulbrichsen had not forgotten that. He could not, in fact, get the picture of it out of his mind. There had been something marvelous, almost magical, about the way they closed out that race. He had to believe that it was still there. But as the Pacific Coast Regatta in California approached in early April, the weather again deteriorated and the sophomore boys could not, for the life of them, seem to regain and hold on to their magic. One day they'd have it, the next day they'd lose it. They would beat the junior varsity on Monday, lose badly on Tuesday, win again on Wednesday, lose on Thursday. When they won, they did so handily. When they lost, they fell apart completely. Fuming, Ulbrichsen went public with his dilemma, telling the Seattle Times on April 2nd, "I've never seen a situation like this. Never before in my experience has a UW training campaign come up to this point without the question of the superiority of a crew being settled long ere this." Still, he had to make a decision. Finally, he did what he had wanted to do all along. He officially proclaimed the entire sophomore boat to be the 1935 first varsity crew. The local papers announced it to the world, and the sophomores promptly lost their next head-to-head race against the JV boat. The JV clamored to be named the varsity boat for the regatta. Ulbrichsen, all but throwing his hands in the air, announced that he'd consider it. They would race one more time in California. Whoever won the first time trial after they arrived in Oakland would row as the varsity crew in the Pacific Coast Regatta. Elevating the sophomores to varsity status was an unusual move, but not unheard of. Kai Ebright was, in fact, in the midst of doing essentially the same thing, perhaps in reaction to all he'd been reading about the Washington sophomores. Improbably, as he had moved toward the Pacific Coast Regatta, Ebright had demoted the varsity boys who had won the national title in Poughkeepsie the year before, in favor of a mixed boat of sophomores and juniors. Only one of the previous year's national champions now sat in his varsity boat, and Ebright remained perplexed by the poor performance of the older boys. When Royal Brougham arrived in Oakland to cover the regatta, Ebright pleaded with him, "Will you please tell me why the crew that last June was the best in the U.S. can't row fast enough to beat a pickup boat of sophomores and JV oarsmen?" Brougham had no idea why, but he was happy to telegraph the intelligence to Ulbrichsen up in Seattle. And to add a warning, he had put a stopwatch on Ebright's new pickup boat. "Don't get the idea that the new Bear Varsity is slow, Mr. Ulbrichsen. This boat has plenty of get-up about it." When Ulbrichsen learned the details, particularly the fact that Ebright had replaced even Dick Burnley, the enormous stroke who had powered Cal to victory over his boys in Poughkeepsie, he could only have been stunned. He knew that Ebright was looking beyond this year to 36, looking for younger talent, just as he was. But who on earth could Ebright have found that would knock a machine like Burnley out of a national championship boat? By 8 o'clock on the morning of April 7th, all three Washington crews were in California, out on the oil-slicked waters of the Oakland estuary, rowing in the rain with a 30-mile-per-hour wind whipping off in San Francisco Bay, pushing salt spray in their faces for the first time. Except for the taste of salt in the water, they felt right at home. They'd brought a bit of Seattle South with them. Cal was nowhere to be seen. They rowed the length of the estuary and out along the mudflats on the east shore of the bay. The silver towers of the partially completed bay bridge rose dramatically from the water before them, elegant spires stretching with surprising grace across the bay toward Treasure Island and San Francisco. Out in the open bay, though, the chop was even heavier, heavy enough to threaten to swamp the boats. Ulbrichsen turned them around. On the way out, it had seemed to him that the junior varsity boat was moving better than the sophomores. On the way back in, the sophomores seemed to be going better than the junior varsity. Everyone waited for Ulbrichsen to stage the decisive time trial that he had promised before leaving Seattle. Nobody in either shell talked much to anybody in the other. Meanwhile, Al Ulbrichsen and Kai Ebright performed their practiced dance, the Dance of Doom. Each tried to outdo the other in gloomy prognostications for the upcoming regatta. Ulbrichsen announced that his boys were too heavy, badly out of shape as a result of all the canceled workouts in Seattle. He'd hoped but failed to boil them down to fighting trim by now. "Rate them for the dark horses that they are," he said. "My boys are not ready for a race. They started out to row 3 miles yesterday, and they were sitting on their tongues at the end of the first mile. We've never had less work and poorer conditions." Reporters, though, noted that the boys had looked pretty darn fit when they'd stepped off the train. When asked why he'd showed up with a boatload of sophomores, Ulbrichsen looked at the reporter balefully and said, "They're the best we've got." Ebright, trying to swing perceptions the other way, said less but was more direct when he said anything. Talking to the New York Times, he claimed flat out, "California has a chance, but I think Washington will win," and added, "Our chances are not so hot. Our varsity is undoubtedly slower than last year's shell, and is inexperienced entirely in racing." He continued to remain oddly silent about his own boys. On April 10th, Ulbrichsen finally staged the formal time trial that was to determine who would race as the varsity. Joe and his sophomore crewmates came in almost a length behind the JV. They slumped in their shell in despair and disbelief. The boys in the JV boat were jubilant. Al Ulbrichsen went back to the hotel and scrawled in his logbook, "In a hell of a fix now." But he still didn't announce a varsity boating. On the morning of April 12th, the same thing happened. But now Ulbrichsen tried one more trick. The sophomores had come south in a new, still-unchristened shell, but they had taken an immediate dislike to it. They'd been complaining since they had arrived that it just didn't swing for them. So Ulbrichsen sent them out one more time, this time in their old shell, the one in which they had won so convincingly at Poughkeepsie, the city of Seattle. They rowed beautifully and matched the JV's time. The old boat made them feel right at home, Ulbrichsen noted in his logbook. After dinner at the Hotel Oakland that night, he dropped the bomb on the JV. He was going to race the sophomores as the varsity, despite their repeated defeats. "I'm sorry," he said. "I probably shouldn't do this, but I can't help it." The JV boys walked out of the room enraged, stormed out into the dark, and tried to walk off their anger on the streets of Oakland. Explaining the reversal to the Associated Press, Ulbrichsen broke cover, abandoned the dance of doom, and said simply what he believed in his heart about the sophomores. They were, he declared, potentially the best crew I have ever coached. But in his logbook that night he wrote miserably, "Hell of a position to be in the day before the race." Race day, April 13th, was again rainy, and a stiff headwind blew out of the south up the length of the Oakland estuary. The estuary was not what anyone might call pristine rowing water, even on the best of days. A long, narrow slot of water between Oakland and Alameda Island, it was essentially a marine highway through an already aging industrial landscape. Spanned by several steel bridges, there was a slight curve in the race course at Union Point, just before the finish line at the Fruitvale Avenue Bridge. Crumbling brick warehouses, oil storage tanks, rusting cranes, and gritty factories lined both sides of the waterway. Tied up along its shores was every conceivable kind of watercraft. Chinese junks, tugboats, rickety houseboats, old schooners and barges, heaped with jumbles of industrial cargo. The water itself was turgid, gray-green even on sunny days, oil-slicked and reeking of diesel fuel and seaweed. Right next to Cal's shell house, a 4-inch pipe discharged raw sewage directly into the water. It was a challenging landscape in which to find a place to watch a crew race, but by mid-afternoon on April 13th, nearly 40,000 spectators had assembled under umbrellas in empty lots, on scattered docks, on warehouse rooftops, and on small craft moored along the racecourse. By far the greatest concentration of fans was at the finish line, on the Fruitvale Avenue Bridge. There, thousands of California fans, dressed in blue and gold, mingled on the span with hundreds of Washington loyalists in purple and gold, everyone jostling to get a good view of the water. Radio announcers sat huddled under a shelter near the bridge, ready to broadcast the results around the nation. At 3:55 p.m., the regatta got started with the 2-mile freshman race. Don Hume, Washington's stroke, was just a few days out of the infirmary and still recovering from severe tonsillitis, but you wouldn't have known it by watching the race. The Washington freshman jumped out early to a half-length lead. At the halfway mark, they led by a full length, with both crews rowing at 32. As they came around the bend and into the final stretch, the Cal freshman tried to rally, edging their rate up to 34. Washington upped its rate to match Cal's. With both boats rowing at the same rate, Hume's stroke made all the difference. In the last quarter mile, Hume rowed so smoothly, so powerfully, and so efficiently that with the boys behind him falling into sync, the Washington boat powered still farther ahead and crossed the line 3 lengths ahead of California. Officials on the bridge dropped a white flag to signify a win for the White Blades of Washington. The junior varsity race was, for the suddenly demoted older boys from Washington, all about making a point, and about opening up the future. At 4:10 p.m., still seething under Ulbrichsen's reversal, they brought their boat up to the starting line at the foot of Webster Street, just south of Jack London Square and 3 miles from the finish. When the start was called, California jumped out in front and then settled in at 32. With Bobby Mock calling the cadence and Big Stub McMillan in the engine room, Washington slowly and methodically pulled even and then began to edge ahead. By the halfway mark, they had open water between themselves and the Cal boat. Then they started rowing in earnest. Mock barked at them to raise the stroke, and then barked again. They dug hard. With every stroke, they began to punish Cal and Ulbrichsen and the sophomores and anyone else who might doubt them, unleashing months' worth of frustration, demolishing the course, hurling their backs into the oncoming wind and rain. Bobby Mock had a habit of calling for Big Tens by attaching someone's name to the call, to give it a more emotional impact. Sometimes it was, "Give me 10 for Al," or, "Give me 10 for Mr. Pocock." Now he shouted through his megaphone, "Give me 10 big ones for Joe Beasley." Nobody in the boat, including Mock, apparently, had ever heard of Joe Beasley, but he was having fun now. They gave him 10 big ones. Then he screamed, "And give me 10 big ones for those sophomores." The boat exploded forward. As they came around the bend and within sight of the crowd on the bridge, they were 5 lengths ahead. As they shot across the line and under the bridge, they were 8 lengths ahead and still pulling away. When it came time for the varsity race, the Cal fans finally got something to cheer about. As Joe and the sophomore varsity paddled to their starting position, they figured that they pretty much had to win now, after what the JV had just done, not only to justify Obrigson's faith in them, but to keep their Olympic aspirations alive. From now on, in fact, they figured they had to win every race or it would be all over for them. Over the next 16 minutes, they did everything they could to make sure it wasn't all over. After the race, the San Francisco Chronicle's tough-as-nails sports editor, Bill Leiser, said simply, "It was a great battle, the best race I ever saw on the estuary." Cal had been practicing fast starts all week, but neither boat was quite ready at the start. Once they were away, Washington leapt out to an early lead. Cal responded quickly and decisively, raising its rate and pulling even, then moving quickly out in front by half a length. Both boats settled in and held their positions for the next mile and a half, with Washington's blades dipping in and out of the water almost stroke for stroke with Cal's at a steady 30 strokes per minute. As they approached Government Island and the halfway mark, California slowly increased its rate and stretched its lead out to a full length. George Maury in the coxswain seat called for more, and the Washington rate went up to 32. But Maury held it there as Cal went up to 34 and a half, refusing to yield to the temptation to panic or bolt. Ever so slowly, Washington began to claw its way back inch by inch, still keeping the rate low but starting to gain on sheer power. By the time they reached the south end of the island, the Cal lead had been whittled down to a quarter of a length. Then they were bow to bow. Approaching the bend in the course, Washington slowly nosed out ahead of the California boat. Washington went up to 34 now, Cal to a punishing 38. The two boats swung around the bend side by side and surged into view of the fans on the bridge. An armada of launches and pleasure craft was following them. Observers in those boats, studying the boys through binoculars, thought both crews looked tired. California made a move, starting to sprint, going up to 40 strokes per minute, and charging forward again, back into the lead. The Cal fans erupted in cheers. Their boys were out in front by a quarter of a length, bearing down on the finish line. But George Maury did what he had been told to do. Ulbrichsen had instructed him to keep the stroke rate as low as he could for as long as he possibly could. With his boys still rowing at 34, Maury resisted the temptation to call for a higher rate, even as Cal maintained its frantic 40 and the Fruitvale Avenue Bridge began to loom up ahead of them. Stroke rate is one thing and power is another. Maury knew he still had plenty of power at his disposal. He figured that by now Cal almost certainly didn't. He leaned forward and called out, "Gimme 10 big ones." The Washington boys dug hard. The boat leapt forward. At the end of 10 strokes, the bows of the boats were dead even again. With the bridge and the finish line closing on them, Maury screamed again, "Give me 10 more!" Joe and Shorty and Roger and everyone with an oar in his hands threw everything he had into the last few pulls. In the coaching launch directly behind his boys, Al Ulbrichsen held his breath. The boats shot onto the bridge side by side. A blue flag and a white flag dropped from the bridge simultaneously. The fans fell suddenly silent, confused. Someone in one of the following boats shouted, "Washington, by a foot!" The husky fans roared. Then a voice on the official loudspeaker boomed out, "California, by 2 feet!" Now the Cal fans roared. The radio broadcasters huddling under the shelter hesitated, then beamed the news out to the nation. "California wins!" The same message rattled out over the news wires. On the bridge, Washington fans were adamant, pointing angrily at the water, gesticulating. Their boys had surged ahead at the end. Anyone could see that. California fans who had been leaning over the railing as the boats passed below insisted that the nose of the Cal boat had gone under the bridge first, by 3 feet at least. The pandemonium increased. Long minutes passed, and then, suddenly, the voice on the loudspeaker crackled back to life. Judges of the finish announce officially that Washington won by 6 feet. An enormous moan rose from the California fans, en masse. In Seattle, a news flash from Oakland interrupted regular radio programming, and people who had been sitting dejectedly by the radio stood up and slapped each other on the back and shook hands. It turned out that neither crew, nor any of the official judges, had ever really had any doubt about the outcome. They just had trouble getting to the loudspeaker through the throng of people on the bridge. What most spectators had not realized was that the bridge ran across the estuary at a slight angle. The finish line, on the other hand, ran straight across the water, just about intersecting the bridge on the California side of the racecourse, but intersecting the Washington side several yards short of the bridge. The nose of the California boat had indeed passed under the bridge first, but by then the first 6 feet of the Washington boat was already well over the line. When Ulbrichsen got back to the hotel that night, he jotted a simple commentary in the logbook, "Quite a day." The train ride home was jubilant. The hard feelings of the long fall and winter were forgotten. Everyone had come out a winner. Tom Bowles was sure now he had a freshman crew at least equal to that of the previous year. The junior varsity had made their point, at least for now. The sophomores were the Pacific Coast varsity champions. Together they had swept California from its home water. Anything now seemed possible. The day following the race, it was front-page news in Seattle, a banner headline in the Seattle Times trumpeting, "Husky Crew Makes Clean Sweep." On April 18th, the city held its version of a ticker tape parade to honor the crews, as well as a girls' swim team that had just returned from Chicago with a handful of medals and 6 national records, and Jack Medica, a superstar swimmer who had himself just returned from victories in the East. 80 members of the Husky Marching Band led the procession up 2nd Avenue and Pike Street as confetti and scraps of paper mixed with a steady, cold rain drifting down from clouds high above. Behind the band, in a flower-bedecked car, Mayor Smith rode with Al Ulbrichsen and Tom Bowles, waving at the cheering crowd that lined the street 4 and 5 deep. Medica and the girls' swim team rode in a second car. Then came the main attraction, a long logging truck draped with flowers and green foliage, carrying the varsity crew and their shell. The boys wore white sweaters with big purple W's emblazoned on them. Each held a 12-foot-long oar upright. As it crawled through downtown, the float looked something like an enormous green reptile with a sleek cedar spine and 8 wavering spruce quills. From time to time, a relative or friend of one of the boys called out a greeting from the sidewalk or ran out into the street for a quick handshake. Joyce was at work, but Joe scanned the faces in the crowd, looking for his father or his half-siblings, but they were nowhere to be seen. The procession made its way to the Washington Athletic Club on Union Street. There, the boys were ushered into a smoky room packed with hundreds of Seattle's leading citizens, each of whom had paid 75 cents to attend a special luncheon and get an up-close look at the returning heroes. Royal Brougham was the master of ceremonies, and the proceedings were broadcast live on radio. The mayor, Tom Bowles, and Al Ulbrichsen each gave brief talks. Ulbrichsen heaped praise on all 3 crews, and ended by saying, to cheers, "With support like this, we'll win at Poughkeepsie, and then it will be on to Berlin and the Olympics." The dean of the university spoke, as did the president of the Chamber of Commerce. Pretty much everything who was anyone in town wanted in on the act. Then the boys from all 3 boats were called up onto the stage. Each was introduced, one at a time, each to long and sustained applause. When it was Joe's turn, he stood for a moment looking out over the scene before him. White light poured into the room from tall windows flanked by heavy velvet curtains. Enormous crystal chandeliers hung shimmering from high, ornately plastered ceilings. The beaming faces of large-bellied men in 3-piece suits and matronly-looking women bedecked with jewelry gazed up at him. They sat at tables spread with crisp white linen tablecloths and gleaming silverware and crystal stemware and platters heaped with hot food. Waiters in white coats and black bow ties scurried among the tables, carrying trays with still more food. As Joe raised a hand to acknowledge the wave of applause rising to greet him, he found himself struggling desperately to keep back tears. He had never let himself dream of standing in a place like this, surrounded by people like these. It startled him, but at the same time it also filled him with gratitude, and as he stood in front of the room that day acknowledging the applause, he felt a sudden surge of something unfamiliar, a sense of pride that was deeper and more heartfelt than any he had ever felt before. Now it was on to Poughkeepsie again, and then maybe even Berlin. Everything finally seemed to be starting to turn golden. Chapter 10. A boat is a sensitive thing, an eight-oared shell, and if it isn't let go free, it doesn't work for you. George Yeoman Pocock. In an age when Americans enjoy dozens of cable sports channels, when professional athletes often command annual salaries in the tens of millions of dollars, and when the entire nation all but shuts down for a virtual national holiday on Super Bowl Sunday, it's hard to fully appreciate how important the rising prominence of the University of Washington's crew was to the people of Seattle in 1935. Seattle was a city that had long been considered, and was sometimes prone to consider itself, a backwater in many regards, and not least in the world of sports. The university's football team had historically been a winning proposition, with an astonishing accomplishment to its credit, a record 63 consecutive games without a defeat between 1907 and 1917. During that streak, under Coach Gil Doby, Washington scored 1,930 points to its opponents' 118. But it must be noted that Doby's adherence to the rules may have been a wee bit lax. On one occasion, he was reputed to have fit a pair of his smaller players with iron shoulder pads, an equipment adjustment that gave the fellows a seemingly uncanny ability to take down much bigger men. At any rate, the Washington Sun Dodgers, rebranded the Huskies at the suggestion of the 1922 crew, played almost entirely on the West Coast, and made it to the national stage of the Rose Bowl only twice, once tying Navy and once losing to Alabama. Seattle baseball had never really made it onto a national stage at all. There had been a succession of professional ball teams in town since May 24, 1890, when the Seattle Reds took on the Spokane Falls Spokanes. In the years that followed, the city had seen baseball teams variously called the Seattles, the Klondikers, the Rainmakers, the Braves, the Giants, the Rainiers, the Sawashes, the Indians, and at one unfortunate juncture, the Seattle Clamdiggers. But all these were minor league teams that played only in local and regional contests. And baseball in Seattle had recently experienced a major setback, one of many more to come, when the wooden stands at the Indians ballpark, Dugdale Park, burned to the ground in July 1932. The team had moved to Civic Field, a high school football stadium, but the field had no grass, and was little more than a rectangle of dirt and stones. During and between games, grounds crews scurried about with gunny sacks, picking up as many rocks as possible, to keep the players from tripping over them when racing for a fly ball or flaying themselves alive when sliding into a base. It proved to be a hopeless cause and an endless task. One of the high schoolers who played there, Edo Vanni, later the manager of the Rainiers, said of the field, "If a horse got stranded out there, he would have starved to death. It was nothing but rocks." For decades, baseball fans in Seattle had to choose an Eastern team to root for if they wanted a stake in the big leagues. Seattle sports had once risen briefly to international prominence in 1917, when the city's professional hockey team, the Metropolitans, became the first American team to win the Stanley Cup, defeating the Montreal Canadiens. But the Metropolitans ordinarily played only in the Pacific Coast Hockey Association, and when the owner of their arena did not renew their lease in 1924, the team folded. Given this meager sports heritage, the Washington Crew's victories gave Seattleites something they hadn't had in a long time, something, in fact, that they had never really had. With the sweep in California, recent victories in Poughkeepsie, and now talk even of future victories in the Olympics, any Seattleite could suddenly stick out his chest and crow a bit. He could write to friends and relations back east about it. He could read about it in the Post-Intelligencer in the morning, and then enjoy reading about it again in the Seattle Times in the evening. He could talk to the barber about it when getting a haircut, and know that the barber cared about it as much as he did. Those boys in their boats were, length by length and victory by victory, suddenly beginning to put Seattle on the map. And they were likely to do more of it in the near future. Everyone in town believed that now, and it pulled them together and made them feel better about themselves in a deeply troubled time. If they lingered too long over the front page of the Times or the Post-Intelligencer, though, Seattleites could not avoid seeing harbingers of other troubles to come. On April 14th, the day after the Pacific Coast Regatta on the Oakland Estuary, the dust storms of the past several years were suddenly eclipsed by a single catastrophe that is still remembered in the Plain States as Black Sunday. In only a few hours' time, cold, dry winds howling out of the north scoured from dry fields more than two times the amount of soil that had been excavated from the Panama Canal and lifted it 8,000 feet into the sky. Across much of five states, late afternoon sunlight gave way to utter darkness. The dust particles the wind carried generated so much static electricity in the air that barbed wire fences glowed in the midday darkness. Farmers at work in their fields crumpled to their hands and knees and groped aimlessly about, unable to find their way to their own doorsteps. Cars careened off roads and into ditches, where their occupants, clutched close to their faces, struggled to breathe, gagged and coughed up dirt. Sometimes they abandoned their cars and staggered up to the houses of strangers and pounded on their front doors, begging for and receiving shelter. The next day, Kansas City AP Bureau Chief Ed Stanley inserted the phrase, "the Dust Bowl," into a wire service account of the devastation, and a new term entered the American lexicon. Over the next few months, as the extent of the devastation settled in, the trickle of ragged refugees that Joe Rance had witnessed heading west the previous summer became a torrent. Within a few years, 2.5 million Americans would pull up stakes and head west into an uncertain future, rootless, dispossessed, bereft of the simple comfort and dignity of having a place to call home. For months, things had been looking up in America. Job offerings had begun to appear again in the Seattle Times and the Post-Intelligencer, as they had in hundreds of newspapers across the country. Men like Harry Rance had finally begun to find meaningful work. But the winds of April 14th suddenly blew away the slowly accumulating hopes of millions. Within weeks, the Post-Intelligencer was warning the locals to expect company and competition for those jobs soon. Great migration westward about to begin. Home seekers look upon Northwest as promised land, read a Post-Intelligencer headline on May 4th. Employment agencies in Seattle received inquiries about the availability of jobs, any kind of job, no matter how low-paying, from as far away as Missouri and Arkansas. Most of the migrants were farmers, and real estate offices were flooded with inquiries about the availability of cheap acreage near Seattle. Eager agents answered the inquiries with assurances that there was plenty of inexpensive land available. But they seldom mentioned that around the Puget Sound, acreage generally came with stumps, hundreds of stumps per acre, each of which had to be pulled or dug or dynamited out of the earth. Nor did they mention that the underlying soil was glacial till, hard-packed clay interlaced with stones, nor that the climate was cool and gray, not suited for growing the kinds of crops that had long sustained the people of the American Midwest. At the same time, the drumbeat of ominous headlines emanating from Europe had begun to grow steadily louder and more insistent that spring. 4 weeks' worth of headlines from the Seattle Times alone were reason enough for worry. "Death penalty for pacifists is decreed as Germany girds," April 19th. "Nazis jail aged nuns, monks in new attack on Christianity," April 27th. "German move to build U-boats rouses anxiety in Great Britain," April 28th. "Britain to match Nazi planes calls on Hitler to fix limits," May 2nd. "Hitler warned by Britain not to militarize Rhineland zone," May 7th. "Nazis have new weapon, 60-knot boat," May 17th. "Hitler police jail U.S. citizen," May 18th. The dark news was difficult to ignore, but not impossible. The vast majority of Americans in Seattle and elsewhere did exactly that. The affairs of Europe still seemed a million miles away, and that's exactly where most people wanted to keep them. On the first day of training for Poughkeepsie, Ulbrichtsen surprised a gaggle of sports writers at the Shell House by announcing that the sophomores weren't necessarily going to keep their varsity status in Poughkeepsie, despite their win in Oakland. He pointed out that there were older boys in the junior varsity boat with a lot of experience and talent. Some of them deserved a shot at a national varsity championship before they graduated. Insofar as it went, Ulbrichtsen was probably entirely sincere on that point. He had, in fact, felt bad about disappointing the older boys in Oakland, especially in light of the fact that they had won the final trials on the estuary after he had broken his word to them. But there was something else. He was well aware that the older boys had utterly dominated their competition in Oakland. The sophomores, on the other hand, had won by the narrowest of margins, and they had caused their coach a good deal of heartburn while he waited for the official results. That hadn't helped their cause at all. Joe and the other sophomores couldn't believe it. They hadn't just beaten another crew on the estuary, they'd beaten Cal's varsity, the defending national champions. They'd reached beyond themselves to defeat older and much more experienced boys, the same crew that Ebright would presumably take to Poughkeepsie. Yet suddenly their varsity status was back on the line again. Furious, they resolved to put the JV boys in their place as soon as they got out on the water. Instead, they thoroughly sabotaged themselves and their cause. On May 9th, Ulbrichtsen held another head-to-head contest between the two boats. Riding along in Ulbrichtsen's launch was an important guest, J. Lyman Bingham of the Amateur Athletic Union, a close associate of Avery Brundage, the president both of the AAU and the American Olympic Committee. When Ulbrichtsen shouted the start command through his megaphone, "Ready all, row," the JV boat, with Bobby Mock in the stern, pulled away from the sophomores promptly, easily, and decisively. Ulbrichtsen gunned the motor on the launch, ran the two boats down, and bellowed, "Way enough!" He lined them up again and called another start. Again, the JV pulled away decisively. Bingham turned to Ulbrichtsen and asked dryly, "Which did you say was the varsity? Maybe I'm watching the wrong crew." Ulbrichtsen was flummoxed. Over the next several weeks, Ulbrichtsen raced the two boats against each other again and again. Occasionally the sophomores won, but usually they lost. They rowed well when left on their own, but the moment they got a glimpse of the older boys, they fell apart completely. Months of taunting had gotten under their skins. In April, Ulbrichtsen had all but crowed to both national wire services that this all-sophomore crew was great, potentially the greatest crew I have coached, he'd said, in front of the whole world. Now they seemed bent on making a fool of him. He marched them into his office, closed the door, and read them the riot act. "If you cannot get to doing business, I will break up the combination," he growled. Ulbrichtsen hated to even say it. He still had not forgotten the stunning manner in which the sophomores had won the freshman title in Poughkeepsie the year before, nor had anybody else. Almost every press account that mentioned them still harkened back to that moment in New York when their boat had pulled away from the field as if propelled by young gods rather than by young men. But Ulbrichtsen knew that in the end it wasn't gods but young men who had to win crew races, and unlike gods, young men were fallible. It was his job to find their failings, and remedy them, if he could, and to replace them, if he couldn't. Rowing is, in a number of ways, a sport of fundamental paradoxes. For one thing, an eight-oared racing shell, powered by unusually large and physically powerful men or women, is commanded, controlled, and directed by the smallest and least powerful person in the boat. The coxswain, nowadays often a female, even in an otherwise male crew, must have the force of character to look men or women twice his or her size in the face, bark orders at them, and be confident that the leviathans will respond instantly and unquestioningly to those orders. It is perhaps the most incongruous relationship in sports. Another paradox lies in the physics of the sport. The object of the endeavor is, of course, to make the boat move through the water as quickly as possible. But the faster the boat goes, the harder it is to row well. The enormously complicated sequence of movements, each of which an oarsman must execute with exquisite precision, becomes exponentially more difficult to perform as the stroke rate increases. Rowing at a beat of 36 is vastly more challenging than rowing at a beat of 26. As the tempo accelerates, the penalty of a miscue, an oar touching the water a fraction of a second too early or too late, for instance, becomes ever more severe, the opportunity for disaster ever greater. At the same time, the exertion required to maintain a high rate makes the physical pain all the more devastating and therefore the likelihood of a miscue greater. In this sense, speed is both the rower's ultimate goal and also his greatest foe. Put another way, beautiful and effective rowing often means painful rowing. An unnamed coach is reputed to have said bluntly, "Rowing is like a beautiful duck. On the surface it is all grace, but underneath the bastard's paddling like mad." But the greatest paradox of the sport has to do with the psychological makeup of the people who pull the oars. Great oarsmen and oarswomen are necessarily made of conflicting stuff, of oil and water, fire and earth. On the one hand, they must possess enormous self-confidence, strong egos, and titanic willpower. They must be almost immune to frustration. Nobody who does not believe deeply in himself or herself, in his or her ability to endure hardship and to prevail over adversity, is likely even to attempt something as audacious as competitive rowing at the highest levels. The sport offers so many opportunities for suffering, and so few opportunities for glory, that only the most tenaciously self-reliant and self-motivated are likely to succeed at it. And yet, at the same time, and this is key, no other sport demands and rewards the complete abandonment of the self the way that rowing does. Great crews may have men or women of exceptional talent or strength. They may have outstanding coxswains or stroke oars or bowmen. But they have no stars. The team effort. The perfectly synchronized flow of muscle, oars, boat, and water. The single, whole, unified, and beautiful symphony that a crew in motion becomes is all that matters. Not the individual. Not the self. The psychology is complex. Even as rowers must subsume their often fierce sense of independence and self-reliance, at the same time they must hold true to their individuality, their unique capabilities as oarsmen or oarswomen, or for that matter, as human beings. Even if they could, few rowing coaches would simply clone their biggest, strongest, smartest, and most capable rowers. Crew races are not won by clones. They are won by crews. And great crews are carefully balanced blends of both physical abilities and personality types. In physical terms, for instance, one rower's arms might be longer than another's, but the latter might have a stronger back than the former. Neither is necessarily a better or more valuable oarsman than the other. Both the long arms and the strong back are assets to the boat. But if they are to row well together, each of these oarsmen must adjust to the needs and capabilities of the other. Each must be prepared to compromise something in the way of optimizing his stroke for the overall benefit of the boat. The shorter-armed man reaching a little farther, the longer-armed man foreshortening his reach just a bit, so that both men's oars remain parallel and both blades enter and exit the water at precisely the same moment. This highly refined coordination and cooperation must be multiplied out across 8 individuals of varying statures and physiques to make the most of each individual's strengths. Only in this way can the capabilities that come with diversity, lighter, more technical rowers in the bow and stronger, heavier pullers in the middle of the boat, for instance, be turned to advantage rather than disadvantage. And capitalizing on diversity is perhaps even more important when it comes to the characters of the oarsmen. A crew composed entirely of 8 amped-up, overly aggressive oarsmen will often degenerate into a dysfunctional brawl in a boat or exhaust itself in the first leg of a long race. Similarly, a boatload of quiet but strong introverts may never find the common core of fiery resolve that causes the boat to explode past its competitors when all seems lost. Good crews are good blends of personalities. Someone to lead the charge, someone to hold something in reserve, someone to pick a fight, someone to make peace, someone to think things through, someone to charge ahead without thinking. Somehow, all this must mesh. That's the steepest challenge. Even after the right mixture is found, each man or woman in the boat must recognize his or her place in the fabric of the crew, accept it, and accept the others as they are. It is an exquisite thing when it all comes together in just the right way. The intense bonding and the sense of exhilaration that results from it are what many oarsmen row for, far more than for trophies or accolades. But it takes young men or women of extraordinary character, as well as extraordinary physical ability, to pull it off. That's what Al Ulbrichtsen believed he had seen in Washington's sophomore boat in Poughkeepsie the previous June. They had become that perfect thing that all crew coaches seek. He remained almost desperately reluctant now to tear the fabric of what held them together then, but the boys seemed to be leaving him no choice. They seemed to have come unraveled, all on their own. On May 22nd,